This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Neil Conan is on vacation. Summertime, lazy book-reading afternoons in the hammock, early morning walks before the heat of the day sets in, backyard barbecues, kids catching lightning bugs in the fading light of a summer night, mosquitoes, the bane of summertime, even more so these days with the threat of West Nile virus lurking in their insistent buzz. Mosquitoes and the illnesses that come with them have always been with us, and though scientists have learned much about how to control them, they have not conquered them. So human beings have to learn how to live with them and how to avoid the potential dangers they pose to their health. How do you deal with these bewinged bloodsuckers? Are you having more encounters than usual this summer? Are you wondering what's the best way to avoid their sting? Do you have a mosquito horror story to share? Mosquitoes are the talk of the nation today. Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With us in Studio 3A to discuss all things mosquito is Colonel Daniel Strickman, Chief of the Department of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research in Maryland. Thanks so much for being with us, Colonel.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You're a man who actually finds mosquitoes to be beautiful. Explain to me how that can be.
Well, there are about 4,000 species of mosquitoes, and they go all the way from just beautiful metallic blue and red to the ones that you're used to seeing here that may be sort of a plain light brown color.
How did you get interested in this kind of research?
Well, I've been interested in insects really since junior high school when I made an insect collection. And then as I went on through graduate school, there's a need to actually do something with what you're studying. And medical entomology, which is the broad field this includes, offers a lot of scope.
Tell me about the most beautiful mosquito you've ever seen.
Well, the most beautiful mosquito I've ever seen was in South America. And it's a kind of mosquito that doesn't bite at all. It never takes blood. But the larvae, which live in the water, eat other mosquitoes. And it produces a mosquito that's about the size of a housefly. And on its abdomen, it shades from this beautiful metallic green to a beautiful metallic blue with these almost like feathers, crimson feathers, sticking out at the hind end.
Does it have that sound, though? That mosquito sound?
Sure does.
They all do, then.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a function of their flight with the wings.
What's the most dangerous mosquito?
Well, a lot of people agree that Anopheles gambiae, which is a vector or a mosquito that transmits a disease of malaria in Africa, is the most dangerous mosquito.
And what are the mosquitoes here in this country that people are so concerned about right now?
Well, with West Nile virus, there's pretty broad agreement that the Culex mosquitoes are the ones that are transmitting it, the virus, to people. And the reason why they're important is because they not only bite people, but they also bite birds. And they act as a bridge vector between birds, which are supporting the virus, and people, of course, that we're worried about protecting.
Yeah. Maybe you can explain the mosquito's role in the ecosystem, because, of course, to human beings, sometimes they just seem like nothing more than an absolute nuisance and even a threat to health. What role do they serve in the ecosystem?
Well, I think the ecosystem has its own roles, and what exists in the ecosystem functions as it can. There are areas where mosquitoes are the dominant insect, like in the high Arctic. And one would think that that's a very important part of the ecology up there. But then there are other areas, like the southern United States, where they're just one more little aquatic fly. And if they were completely eliminated, it probably wouldn't make much difference.
Now, this is going to sound like a very basic question, but why do they suck blood? What role does that play in their life cycle?
Well, the main purpose for the blood is to develop eggs. They use protein and fats in the blood to develop their eggs. But very recently, it's been found that blood is also an important source of energy for the female mosquito.
In what way?
Well, they actually use it for the energy for flight and just to exist.
Mm-hmm. What happens when a mosquito bites you?
Well, it goes through a series of signals, as far as we know. Actually, the distance that we're sitting apart, a mosquito can probably see its host and responds to movement and dark color and comes closer. Then at that distance, it may start detecting heat and carbon dioxide from breath. Then when it really gets close, it'll be detecting very special chemicals in the skin right before it bites.
We're talking about mosquitoes. My guest is Colonel Dan Strickman. And let's take a call from Tony in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I'm with a class, and we're going to be heading up north to northern Michigan in a week for some art projects and research projects. And we were wondering, is there any way we could try to not get bit by all the pests and everything? Because we heard that the problem is really bad, and we were just figuring out ways to avoid getting bitten and trying to just avoid the pest problem.
Dan?
Sure. There are several things you can do. One is that you've probably already thought of is to use repellents. Many of the commercial repellents are highly effective and will really work if you follow the label directions. But something that people often don't think about is that they can wear the kind of clothing that will protect their skin from bites, long sleeves, high collars, long trousers, that sort of thing can offer a lot of protection. Then finally, something that we don't do much in the United States but is really helpful is to sleep under a bed net at night if there are mosquitoes biting at night.
Right. Does that help you?
Yes, thank you very much.
Great. Yeah, you're welcome.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about preventing mosquito bites, particularly for kids, when they're out playing and there's a lot of mosquitoes around right now. Is DEET the only way to go?
No, there are alternative chemicals. If you look at the labels of various repellents, there are actually quite a variety, maybe half a dozen different basic chemicals. DEET is not particularly poisonous, however. There's not a whole lot of reason to choose an alternative chemical over DEET for that reason, though.
Yeah. But tell us about the use of DEET with children. Is it safe? How safe is it? When should you use it? How long should you use it?
It's safe if you follow label directions. The little bit of extra danger for children is more related to the dose that they get. Because they're small, their surface area is much greater in relation to their body size. So if you cover a kid with DEET, they're actually getting a much greater dose than if you cover an adult with DEET. So that's probably the reason to be a little bit more cautious with children.
What about this mosquito season? How bad is it? What parts of the country are being most affected?
Well, it's a big country, and mosquitoes are highly dependent on temperature and rainfall, basically. Here in the Washington area, where we've had tremendous rain, probably three times the rain that's normal, some species are doing very well because of that, the kinds that develop in large pools of water in the forests and all. And then others have actually suffered, like the ones that are in storm drains, where they've been flushed out over and over again and not had a chance to develop.
What about the threat of West Nile virus? Are people getting overly concerned about that? Is that exaggerated at all? Talk to me a little bit about mosquitoes and the threat of West Nile virus.
Well, you've got to remember that West Nile virus is an importation of a mosquito-borne virus. This is the first time this has happened in about 200 years in the United States. And so it's rather special in that sense. The virus has responded in a way that's very different from where it comes from in North Africa and Europe. It reaches much higher levels of concentration in many of the hosts that it infects in the United States. There's a variety of mosquitoes that are transmitting it that are different, naturally, because we have different mosquitoes than in Europe. So that's part of the concern, is that it's a bit unpredictable what it would do. Also, in the few years that it's been in the United States, it spread much faster than anybody ever predicted would happen. On the other hand, for the individual, it's very unlikely that you as an individual are going to get sick or die from West Nile virus.
Now, it's supposed to be spreading, I think, this summer as far west as California. Is that right?
There were a couple of cases last summer, and I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens in California this year, because California, from a mosquito standpoint, is almost like a different continent. The species are different. The climate, of course, is very different. And we'll just see what the virus does.
Why has it spread so rapidly?
I think because of our, probably primarily because of our bird population. I mean, we have the mosquitoes that are good hosts, and we have abundant mosquito populations in the United States. The control efforts are only in certain cities, so between them there are plenty of mosquitoes. And then we have pretty healthy bird populations through great efforts, and those birds move around and carry the virus.
What are your questions about mosquitoes or West Nile virus? How to prevent mosquito bites? Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Melissa. She's in San Diego, California. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Here's my story. I was about 6 years old, and I was in first grade, and my family just moved into this home that was built in 1928, and every screen in the home was broken. And so the first night we spent in the house, and I went to school the next day, and I was covered in mosquito bites because all the screens were broken. And so I had my head down on the desk. It was like in September. It was so hot and humid, and the teacher came around, and she said, "Oh, what's the matter?" And I turned my arm over so she could see, and my arm was covered in these huge red welts, and I had over 37 mosquito bites on my body that day. And the teacher looked at my arm, and she gasped, and she said, "Oh, my." And she whisked me off to the nurse's office, and the nurse called my mother and told her they needed to come to get me. And my mom said, "Oh, no, she's fine. She's just got mosquito bites." And so it made an indelible impression on me. And to this day, I cannot sleep in a room that has one mosquito. And I'm going camping up in the Sequoia.
Oh, no.
And I'm dreading it.
What do you do when you go camping?
I suffer. I just suffer. That's all I can say. Anything for my kids, I suppose.
Well, you know, some people, most people actually, when they're first bitten by a certain new kind of mosquito, if they move to a new area, a new part of the country, very soon, once they develop an allergic reaction to those mosquitoes, they get a terrible reaction. And then over time, they get more used to it.
I think that's what it was. They were just huge in these red welts. It was horrible.
Yeah, they're great, aren't they?
Yeah. That's my horror story for you.
Well, thanks for your horror story, Melissa.
All righty. Thank you.
I think a lot of people have horror stories. Let's take another call. Jane in Los Angeles. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I actually have a question. I've heard people say that certain blood types or chemistry of an individual be more likely to attract a mosquito than others. Is there any legitimacy to that? And if so, what exactly is that about?
Well, I can answer part yes, that there are definitely big differences in the attractiveness of individual people. For instance, when I'm with my father, I don't get any mosquito bites because they all go to him, and that's a very real thing. On the other hand, we know very, very little about why that is. We assume it's because of skin temperature and skin chemistry, but there's no clear pattern between males and females or older or younger people, that sort of thing.
Oh, there isn't. So that's sort of an old wives' tale, I guess. I mean, I've always thought that it was that women were more susceptible than men.
When not really. However, repellents don't work as well on women as they do on men. And that's well documented. Yeah.
Jane, do you suffer, or do you attract?
I do. I'm one of those people that attract. And I was just in New Mexico a couple of weekends ago with a bunch of friends, and it was very interesting to see that there were people that were bitten and people that weren't. And I spent 6 weeks in Ecuador up in the Andes a few years ago, and we all looked like leopards when we came out. We were in the pre-montane cloud forest. But some people were really much worse than others. And it tended to be people that had darker, warmer skin in terms of color were less likely to be assaulted than those of us who are really fair. And it was an observation that we made. So we started talking about it and wondered if there was some sort of difference.
Isn't that interesting? Everybody has a theory depending on their own situation.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for your call, Jane.
No, thank you.
I know that my husband and daughter and I can all be sitting out on the back porch at night, and the reason I always thought it was gender-related is because my daughter and I go running into the house, and my husband just sits there and says, "There aren't any mosquitoes out here. What are you talking about?" So I think it's one of those things. It's a very individual experience, and we're going to continue talking about mosquitoes, that scourge of summer, when we return. What have you always wanted to know, and do you have any particularly good horror stories to share with us? Also, any home remedies that repel them? Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about mosquitoes today. My guest is Daniel Strickman, Chief of Entomology at the Army's Walter Reed Institute of Research. And joining us now is Fiametta Rocco, author of the new book, The Miraculous Fever Tree, Malaria and the Quest for a Cure That Changed the World. She joins us from the offices of The Economist magazine, where she's also their literary editor. Thanks so much for being with us, Fiametta.
Hi, Lynn. That's very mosquito music you have just said.
That's right. If you'd like to join our discussion about mosquitoes, give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Fiametta, your book looks at the effect that malaria has had on world history. It's felled armies as surely as bullets have, hasn't it?
It certainly has, yes. Certainly has. Most people think that it's really just a disease of the tropics, and in fact I grew up in Africa and my grandfather, my father and I all had malaria, but in the Renaissance times it existed all over the old world, in England, Scandinavia, in Russia, and of course enormously around the Mediterranean, particularly in Rome. It's a city that was surrounded by marshes, and people thought that the fever was something that sometimes miasma that came out of the marshes. It was said that if you caught the fever, you caught it either from the aria or from the mal aria, the bad air.
Now, it took a long time to discover that it was actually mosquitoes that caused the disease. And before that, they actually had found a cure in the 17th century. Let's talk first about that. It was a Jesuit who discovered the cure. How did he find it?
Well, that's right. The old world took malaria to the new world, and it was in the new world that they found the cure. Because of this concentration of malaria in Rome, it was inevitable probably that it would be some kind of religious order that would find a cure for it. The whole business about plants and treating illness was something that was very associated with the religious, and as the Jesuits spread to the new world, they set out looking for cures for the diseases. A lay monk living in Lima, Agostino Salumbrino, appears to have been the first person to send what he found there, the bark of a tree that grew up in the high Andes. He sent strips of this bark back to Rome, where it was tried on malaria cases and found to be very effective.
How did he make the connection, though? I mean, how did he realize that this bark...
That's one of the most interesting things about it, because there doesn't appear to have been any malaria then in Peru. But the Indians used it as a cure for shivering, or some kind of treatment for shivering. And, of course, one of the symptoms of malaria, along with the very, very high fever, is this incredible cold that you get when the fever breaks and the shivering starts. It's now used, of course, mostly as a muscle relaxant. It's used for cramp in the leg. It used to be used for people who had pacemakers. But then it was used for shivering, and that is the one thing that differentiated malaria from other fevers.
And so that's how he made the connection and thought, well, this might work for malaria as well.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, but our topic today is mosquitoes, so I want to get to the mosquito part of this, because it's very interesting that there was such a lag time between the discovery of quinine and its effect on malaria and before they actually realized what caused it, which is the mosquitoes. And that happened during the building of the Panama Canal, is that right?
There was a certain amount of work done in India before that, mm-hmm. but it was really in Panama that this was put into practice. Few people remember now that before the Americans took over the Panama Canal in 1903, it had been a French project. The reason that the French project had collapsed was because of disease. So many workers died of malaria and of yellow fever. When the Americans took over, William Gorgas, who was an extraordinary doctor who had cleaned up Havana after the Cuban-American War, brought in his theories of treatment, which was quinine for everybody, fumigation of homes, killing off mosquitoes, no butts of water anywhere. They were very, very fierce about it. And within a year, Gorgas had pretty much eliminated mosquito-borne diseases from Panama.
Yeah, and it was fascinating the way you described the situation in Panama at that time. They were actually putting buckets of still water around the beds of patients because that kept the spiders out. So they were actually breeding the mosquitoes.
Absolutely, and lots of people were afraid of going into hospital in Panama because it was said that if you didn't have the fever when you went in there, you sure would get it while you were in.
But they were just convinced that it was sanitary conditions.
Well, the spiders are very big, and you wouldn't want to be bitten by one of those.
No. Yeah, you have to choose between two evils there, I think.
But you know, there wouldn't have been a lot of running water in Panama, so it has a tremendous rainfall. One of the ways of collecting fresh water is to put tubs and buckets outside. Every house had one, and that's one of the things that he banned.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about how the discovery of quinine, and you write quite a bit about this in your book, how it enabled the expansion of Western imperialism and how that played into Western imperialism.
Well, it was really the British experience of it. As the British expanded into India, into Palestine, and into Africa, they had taken malaria with them. And in West Africa in particular, it was incredible. For every three people who went, two died of malaria. Quinine changed that. It was an effective treatment, and it allowed them to settle colonies in a way that they hadn't been able to do before. So really, it changed exploration, it changed war, and it changed history.
Now, we were talking before with Colonel Dan Strickman here. He was saying that he has seen so many mosquitoes in his lifetime that he has discovered that some of them are quite beautiful. And we should say that even in this story of malaria, there is the discovery that I guess we have to give some credit to the mosquitoes for of a very beloved summer drink, the gin and tonic.
That's right. Well, one of the things about quinine is that it tastes absolutely disgusting. When the Catholics brought it back to Europe, the Protestants thought that it was a poison. Well, now in India, Indian soldiers who were made to take quinine mixed it up with orange juice, sugar, water, and before long, inevitably, gin. But it was a Calvinist jeweler, a man called Johann Jakob Schwepp, who, having invented non-alcoholic champagne, which was really the original fizzy water, decided that what he really wanted to do was to put the fizz into this quinine tonic. And he was the man who came up with what we in England call Schweppes Indian tonic water.
Well, that we do have him to thank for that, and I guess indirectly mosquitoes. And you tell a great story about your own experience as a child in Africa. You did suffer from malaria and had to drink quinine every Sunday.
We did. It's a ritual, and people still do it. I mean, they will take their different drugs now, but the ritual is still there.
And your grandfather had a way of inducing you to do that.
Well, he was Italian. He was a fantastic cook, and if we took our quinine, we were allowed to choose what we could have for lunch, which inevitably was some kind of wonderful Italian delicacy. So I'm afraid in our house, malaria was vanquished by greed.
I'd like to bring Colonel Strickman into the discussion now because while we're talking with Fiametta about the role that malaria, quinine, the discovery of quinine, mosquitoes, all of this has had on world history, and you are actually still working internationally on protecting U.S. troops from mosquitoes. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that experience that you were
leading. Yes, I mean, that's why there are people like me in the Army. We not only do research on such things as malaria and yellow fever, but also we apply this knowledge to actually protect troops. For instance, right now in Iraq, our soldiers are exposed to a different disease, leishmaniasis, from a different insect, sandflies, and we're working very hard to protect them from that.
You also were in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is that right?
Yes, I was there right after 9/11.
And what was the work you were doing there, and how did it relate to all of this?
Well, I personally was working at a theater level for the entire region to organize the control of mosquitoes, sandflies, flies, all the insects that might hurt our troops.
So this continues to be, as Fiametta outlined in her book, this has plagued armies forever, correct, Fiametta?
Absolutely. In fact, the U.S. Army is probably the single biggest researcher into malaria, in part because during the Second World War, with the fall of Java to the Japanese, where a lot of quinine was being grown, and the fall of Holland to the Germans, because Holland was the place where it was being manufactured, the Allies lost their entire world supply of quinine. And it was this that really led the U.S. Army to start doing all its experiments on chloroquine and all the other synthetic drugs that have come after that.
And this was also, it was also huge during the Civil War here.
It certainly was. I mean, it was, it's, malaria was all over the South, and it was interesting what the Colonel was saying before about people being exposed to mosquitoes, having not been exposed to them before, how they're affected by it. Because, of course, it was the great move of Union forces southwards that really, they were the ones who were most affected by it. And there were over a million cases of malaria during the Civil War and about 10,000 deaths, most of them in among Northern troops.
And just one other thing for you, Meta. There's one forest of cinchona trees left. That's the tree that has the bark that creates quinine, and it's in the Congo. Is that the only source of quinine left in the world?
Well, you can make it in a laboratory, but the only source of natural quinine is in this forest that's in the eastern Congo, really one of the sort of worst places on the planet. And the reason why it's so interesting is that despite all the research that's been done and the development of synthetic drugs, the one drug that there is still, that the malaria parasite still has developed very, very little resistance to, is quinine. And if you catch malaria in Africa, it's not used as a preventative, but if you catch malaria in Africa, the odds are that if you're lucky enough to be treated, you will be treated with this quinine that comes from the eastern Congo.
Well, thanks so much for joining us, Fia Mehta.
Thank you.
Fia Mehta Rucco is the author of The Miraculous Fever Tree, Malaria and the Quest for a Cure That Changed the World. I'm also joined here in Studio 3A by Colonel Daniel Strickman. He is the Chief of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, and we have quite a few people waiting on the line with questions for the Colonel. So let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Randy in West Hollywood, California. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I have a mosquito problem here in the city, in my condo. They seem to come out only at night, and they keep me awake, and I have to wake up in the middle of the night and put, you know, repellent on. And I was wondering if they stay in my house during the day and not so active and then come out at night, where are they hiding, this type of thing.
And how can you get rid of them? Is that what you, is that your underlying question?
You know, I don't know how to get rid of them. I turn on the light usually and just try and find them around the room and swat them with a magazine. What else can you do?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. Thanks for your call, Randy. Dan, where do they come from? Where do they suddenly appear from?
Well, I'm going to make a guess that what he's talking about is Culex cancafasciatus, which is the very mosquito that transmits West Nile in that region, or would. And because he says that they're biting at night and he's right in the middle of a city, so that would be the most likely cause of his problem. And he's absolutely right. They will come in, they'll sort of filter in during the day, and then, but they only bite at night. If you're very careful about screens and screen doors, you can reduce that problem. But also, Los Angeles County has a very good mosquito abatement district, and he could call them and tell them his problem, and they might be able to find the source of those mosquitoes and treat it.
What do you mean by a mosquito abatement district? What would they do? What's their role? What's their...
Well, they're a county organization, and they have the trained personnel to find sites and the trained personnel to apply insecticide to sites legally and safely. And when their attention is drawn to a particular problem in an area, well, they'll try to do their best to do something about it.
Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we're going to take a call now from Anna, and she is in Petaluma, California. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I've been listening to some of the stories, and some of them are just crazy. But when I was in around fifth grade, my school went on a camping trip, and we're all getting just, you know, eaten alive, and we're trying to smacking away at mosquitoes. And on the way home, my friend's complaining how many she has, and she's just itching like crazy. And we're like, well, you know, let's count. And we're counting, and we're like 99, 100, 101. She ends up having like 150 mosquito bites, and we just had to like slather her in calamine lotion.
Wow. Did anybody get sick? Did she get sick?
Nobody got sick, but they just start swelling up, and it was pretty weird.
So there was one girl that just got them all,
just got eaten. Like, yeah.
Well, thanks for your call, Anna. That's
no problem.
That's a good story, and I want to say to the colonel, you gotta get this research cracking on who the people are that are the magnets for mosquitoes.
It's a very interesting question, and actually, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is doing some great research on that.
Yeah, just following up. There's another. We have another email here from somebody who remembers her experience back in Girl Scout camp. She says the girls would say that when you get a mosquito bite, you should take your fingernail and scratch an X over the bite to release the poison. I've always done this to my mosquito bites, and it makes them stop itching. Why would that be?
I have no idea why that would be.
Come on, make something up.
Usually, you know, the itching is an allergic reaction to the saliva that the mosquito pumps into that site. And the mosquito puts the saliva there so that it can feed more easily and lubricate its mouth parts. And, of course, it's the saliva that transmits the disease when they're infected.
Uh-huh.
So the longer they feed, usually the more saliva is in there and the worse it itches subsequently.
I guess whatever works, too, is you should just go
yes,
with whatever works.
Yes.
Here's a good question, an email, Ken, from Gary, and he says, can they see colors, and if so, is there a color that is best to keep them away?
Oh, great question. They can see some colors. They have color receptors in their eyes, but insect vision is very, very different from ours. They see a series of images through separate lenses, and for instance, they're not able to see red, and so that one of the tricks of the trade to catch mosquitoes is to put out a box that's painted red on the inside. The mosquitoes go in there because they like the shelter, but we're able to see them against that red background, even though they think it's black.
Mm-hmm. Would wearing any certain color, would wearing red have any effect? I guess it wouldn't, would it?
They're generally attracted, this is very general, but they're generally attracted to darker colors.
To darker colors.
Yes.
Now, when you go out to parties, do you get these kinds of questions all the time?
sometimes, but actually not that often.
What if there's a lot of mosquitoes there? Don't people start badgering you about them?
Yeah, they ask, why can't you do something about it, et cetera.
And you can't do anything at that moment in
yeah.
time. All right, well, we're going to keep you around for just a few minutes longer because we have lots of questions, emails, and phone calls here on mosquitoes. And we will take some more calls when we return. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. We're talking about mosquitoes today with Colonel Dan Strickman. He's the Chief of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Colonel Strickman, what's your worst experience with mosquito? What's your horror story?
Well, the worst experience I've ever had was years ago when I lived in Paraguay in South America, and a lot of this one kind of mosquito had emerged all at the same time, and I was working in the forest. And at any one moment, you could run your hand down your arm and just leave a solid layer of blood. There were just thousands of mosquitoes feeding at any one moment.
So how many bites did you end up with?
Well, there's no counting. I mean, it was
hundreds, your whole
thousands.
Arm was just...
Yeah.
And your whole body?
Well, I was wearing thick clothing on other parts of my body, but I did have short sleeves on, unfortunately. And a funny thing is that repellents under those conditions don't work well at all. It's like the mosquitoes are in some sort of feeding frenzy and ignore it.
And what was that like? I'm just trying to imagine how you keep working under those circumstances.
Well, I didn't work long. And rather horrifyingly, on the way out of that woods, as I left, I saw a calf that had been killed by the mosquitoes.
Oh, my gosh.
From all the feeding, yeah. So that can happen.
All right, let's take a call now. Thomas in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. This is certainly a fascinating discussion this afternoon and an apt one for people in southeastern Michigan who have been victimized. I think up to 3 dozen people succumbed to fatal West Nile virus last summer in southeastern Michigan. I'm calling to suggest that biodiversity should have its definitely should have its limits, and that mosquitoes and flies and other disease-carrying insects don't belong within that diversity. And I'm calling to ask the obvious question: why is not the federal government sponsoring research to eliminate mosquitoes, flies, and other disease-carrying insects, either through genetic engineering and/or through genetic sterilization of insects?
Colonel Strickman?
Well, of course, the federal government does sponsor a lot of research on those topics and other topics related to trying to blunt the effect of disease-carrying insects. And as you bring out, there's more than one kind. It's more than just mosquitoes. There are other biting flies that are very important in disease transmission. As far as biodiversity, that's also a very interesting comment, in that the mosquitoes that give us the most trouble are the ones that are most related to our own activities, the ones that are free in nature and living without any intersection with us, really are not favored by our activities. I mean, it only makes sense. And so our worst vectors and our worst pests are in some ways created by our own activities.
That's interesting. Alfonso in Tijuana, Mexico. Hi, Alfonso.
Yes. Hi. I have my own home remedy for avoiding mosquito bites.
Okay. How do you do it?
Well, most of the bites I get are at night before I go to bed, so I started changing my bathing habits from early in the morning, I mean, from late at night to early in the morning. So if I go to bed without taking a bath, I don't get bothered by mosquitoes. I don't know if it has to do with sweat or dirt, or, but that works for me.
Colonel Strickman, has he latched onto something that's scientifically proven, or is this just another one of those things that if it works, it works?
Well, to some extent, if it works, it works, but there is some basis for that kind of thing. Certain kinds of sweat and certain skin excretions, although we think of skin as being attractive to biting insects, some of them are actually repellent, and so you may be getting some effect there. And the other is that some soaps have scents that actually are attractive to mosquitoes, and you may be avoiding that by changing your habits.
Thanks for your call, Alfonso.
It's unbelievable. Now I have an excuse not to, you know, keep not bathing at night. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Now, and I also have another home remedy here that's a really interesting one. This is from Ronald. He says, I am from northern Minnesota. I had an uncle, now deceased, who, when being bitten by a mosquito, would stop breathing and the insect would immediately fly off. He did this several times over the years to show me that it wasn't a fluke. Have you heard about this?
No, I have never heard about that. sounds fascinating, though.
So you can't verify that that's a legitimate what is the word I'm looking for? Remedy either. It's just
No. I've heard people claim that if they flex their muscles, they can hold the mouth parts of the mosquito in place, and then it feeds until it bursts. But I've actually never seen that.
So we're teaching you something about mosquitoes.
Absolutely.
Here today. Okay. Here's another email. Are there any foods that we can consume that will somehow cause a repellent-like reaction? I have heard that garlic or some other foods might help.
Yeah, garlic is a very popular topic in mosquito repellents, and there have been some good studies of eating garlic. Now, the garlic itself is somewhat repellent to mosquitoes. If you were to rub garlic on skin, they won't feed as readily. But clearly, eating garlic, a lot of garlic, doesn't really make much difference, because in countries like Korea, where people eat tremendous amounts of garlic, they still have malaria problems and other mosquito problems.
Let's go to Ellie. She's in Los Gatos, California. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, I've got a wonderful remedy for mosquito bites.
Okay.
When you feel the mosquito bite, there's the itch. Do not scratch it. Put your saliva on it. And be patient. Do not scratch it. And in a few minutes, that itch will go away. Keep putting the saliva on it. By 10 minutes, you don't even know you've got a mosquito bite. And yesterday, I had a spider bite, and I did the same thing, and the itch went away.
Wait, you have to keep licking it for 10 minutes?
You don't keep licking it. You just put the saliva
on. Oh, and then you rub it.
It's a place where you can't reach with your, you don't have to do it with your mouth. You can just spit on your fingers and do it that way. But the saliva, for some reason, neutralizes the poison of the mosquito saliva.
That's another great idea.
Another remedy for the man in Los Angeles. If there are mosquitoes in the room when he goes to sleep, he should get some mosquito netting and do what they do in the tropics and put it around his bed. Then that way he would be mosquito-free all night.
That's right. Thanks so much for your advice. And I have to say that Colonel Dan Strickman, I think, gave him the exact same advice. So you're in line with our expert here. Thanks very much for your call. And here's let's take this one last email. It says, a marvelously interesting program indeed. My 9-year-old daughter would be thrilled if you would answer the following question. I understand the female mosquito uses blood to help nourish her eggs, but since both male and female mosquitoes need energy for flying and to live, how come the males do not bite? Thank you. Claudette in Concord, North Carolina.
The males feed, but they don't feed on blood. They feed on sugar sources like nectar from flowers or juices that they find or sometimes even urine. In fact, there are some species of mosquitoes that are very important in pollinating plants.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Colonel.
Hey, it was a real pleasure.
Colonel Daniel Strickman is the Chief of Entomology at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.